Pilot, a Stargate Atlantis fanfiction by Tipper, read by Tasmi, part 5 of the I Sometimes Wonder series. This story is McShep, and it is also the final part of the I Sometimes Wonder series. Chapter 1, A Long Day's Journey. The sky was blue and clear, almost crystalline in its perfection. Only a few wispy clouds drifting across the mantle. The surface below was mostly water, perfectly reflecting the sky and the sun, with occasional islands and stacks of black rock sprinkled with ivy and flowers that spilled down the sides like waterfalls. It was stunning, like something from a dream. The ship he flew was responsive, as if it could read his mind, with a silver hull that gleamed in the sunlight. All around, he could sense the other ships gliding in and out of the basalt islands, skimming over the waves, all acting like extensions of his own body. He remembered sitting in a chair once, a beautiful chair that lit up at his touch, his mind and body melting into the workings like they were one. And from that chair, he could see the whole sky, control hundreds of drones as they knocked down the enemy over and over. This was like that, except more. These weren't just weapons that he could direct, like smart bombs. These were his own cavalry. Every ship had its own controllable mind, an AI that listened and reacted to every thought, idea, impulse that he had. "Pilot, here," he said to the Cosmos, since he wasn't sure it was behind the voice. "Enemy ships approach. Recommend Delta Omega plan 10 o'clock. He didn't even have to move his shield. His ship simply responded to the very idea of 10 o'clock, putting him on a new attack vector. Around him, the other ships he controlled flanked and took defensive positions, covering his six like perfect soldiers. Small black dots peppered the horizon, three of them. He wondered if they were manned or if these were drones. Except they weren't Wraith Darts, his traditional enemy. Were they even enemies? Who were they? He hesitated. "Pilot, your speed is decreasing. Why are you slowing down?" "Base, query. Who are you?" "Pilot, repeat query." "The enemy ships. Who are we fighting?" "That is not relevant. They are the target. You must destroy them." "Why are they the target?" "Follow your orders, pilot. Take them down." He frowned. This wasn't his first run, and these weren't his first targets. But something about these felt different somehow. "Pilot, take them down. That's an order." "An order?" He reacted. His ship sped. He studied the targets, and in his head, information on speed, size, maneuverability, weapons, defensive systems, and shields spooled down like a feed on a computer. Something familiar? "Base, repeat query. Who are they?" he asked again. "They are the enemy. They intend to take you away. You are our only defense. Take them down." Only defense. He could do it. The shields were easily penetrated by his weapon systems, as if they weren't designed to prevent being struck by his kind of ship. The cloaking technology would be visible with his sensors. And the weapons. The weapons, they were familiar. Familiar. He knew those weapons. "Base, repeat query. It is relevant. I need to know. Who are they?" "Pilot, query denied. Orders are clear. Take them down." He felt something metallic in his mouth. Adrenaline. His muscles tensed and clenched, his nerves spasmed, sending pain up and down his legs and up down his arms, up and down his neck. Familiar. They were familiar. "Base," he said roughly. Who are they? Query denied. Who are they? He shouted. He'd never shouted before. The ships surrounding him shuddered. He felt the hesitation in the AIs he governed. His ship all but braked in midair, forward thrusters on maximum. Who are they? Pilot, obey. This is not Shepard. John felt it like a stab to his heart. That voice. Shepard, can you hear me? He knew that voice, knew it like the back of his hand. It was the voice that always answered his questions, was always there for him, familiar. Query, he responded. Who are you? Did you just say, never mind, you know who I am. We've come to rescue you. Rescue me? And interestingly, the three ships on his screen slowed to a stop. They did not attack him or his ships. They just floated above the ocean, just as he and his ships floated above the ocean. One was a brown box. The other two were gunmetal gray and sleek, but much less efficient. What? He called for information. What are you? The screen in his head was blank. Shepard, listen to me. You were kidnapped 3 months ago. I am so, so sorry it's taken us this long to find you. These goddamn little gray rogue bastards. It took us a while to figure out how they... It's not important. We're here. We found you. Found me? That voice. He trusted it. It was more than familiar. It was a voice that made him feel happy. Shepard, listen, we need to know which ship you're on. Is it? Oh, never mind. It's that one. Are you sure, sir? A different voice this time, lower. Of course it's him. It's the leader. Look at it. The others are all swirling around it. He is correct, another voice said, a woman. He knew her voice, too. That has to be him. Plus, it is larger than the others and is the only one with what appears to be a cockpit. Pilot, take down the targets. Shepard frowned. He'd forgotten about base. Oh, no, you don't, Ronnie said. He's not taking down anyone. Shepard, can you shut them out? Yes, that was right. The voice. It was Rodney. Rodney? Yes! Who do you think this was, the Easter Bunny? Can you shut off the evil Asgard feed on your end? Evil Asgard? I don't... He struggled trying to call for more information, for more help, but the ship didn't know what he wanted. I don't understand. They have done something to him, the woman said. To his mind. You think? Ronnie snapped. Shepard, listen to me. I need you to lower your shields. Can you do that? Negative. Cannot compromise mission. Your mission is probably to kill us, your rescue party. So compromising your mission seems like a good thing to me. Pilot, respond. Ah, they've gone around my block, damn it. Pilot, abort mission. Return to base. Can you not simply cut their radio transmission? The woman said. Not from here. I can only dampen their stupid frequency, which I thought I had, but those sneaky little... We should have taken out their stupid outpost first. This was another voice, much lower than the others, and much more gruff. And risk them whisking him away before we could talk to him? They couldn't have whisked him away if they were dead. You're assuming that they were all in that outpost and not... Ronan! Rodney! This is not the time! Ronan. Rodney. Taylor? Taylor, he said out loud. Yes, she said, her voice filled with warmth. Yes, it is us. We are here for you. Query, why? Why? Ronnie's voice had lifted to almost ear-piercing levels. Are you kidding? You were kidnapped. They stole you. We are taking you home. Do you not remember? Tayla asked. No, he did not. He didn't remember much of anything. He'd just been pilot. Then we'll remind you, Ronan said. Please, Tayla said, lower your shields. Pilot, Base called. We are sending reinforcements. Stand by. Damn it, Ronnie swore. Shepard, you need to trust us, please. Sir, if he can't remember. You know what? Ronnie snapped. You don't get to talk. You just fly. What's your name again? Medgar? Merkel? Messing, sir. Right. Messing. Shut up. Shepard, one last chance or I'm forcing those shields open. You hear me? We are not leaving you behind. So lower those damn shields and... Incoming, Messing yelled. Shepard jumped as countermeasures exploded all around his ship. He banked away, pulling hard to steepen the angle, even as his sensors went crazy. Around him, the other ships spread out, and two went straight up, seeking clarity above the fray. Base, he shouted. What are you doing? Taking control, pilot. You have been compromised. And in that moment, he felt it happen. Like having a weight taken off his shoulders, control of his ship was pulled away, control over the other ships was cut off completely, and he could feel the hands of another sending new orders into his ship's navigation. And weapons. No! Shepard, please! Ronnie's voice broke through the clatter, even as he lost sight of the puddle jumper and the F-302s and... Puddle jumper. F-302s. Atlantis. Shepard exerted his last bit of control, existing now just on the edges of total failure, to lower the shield right before it was entirely yanked away. Shield is down, he shouted. Caldwell, now! Somewhere outside Shepard's vision, a massive burst of bright light filled the cockpit. Then there was a gasp, and something pressing down on his shoulder. He couldn't see him. Why couldn't he see him? Oh my God, what did they do to you? Rodney, he asked, I can't see you, feel you. I can't control the ship anymore. They're in control and they're going to steer us away if... Yes, right, sorry, hang on. He heard a click. Tayla, Ronan, get out of here. I've got him. Take care of whatever is shooting at you while I get him free. And something was shouting at the jumper and the F-302s. Shepard could feel it now. He had his access to the sensors taken away, and his visual was down, but he could hear the booming of explosions. His ship, their ship, rocked with the force of them as it picked up speed to take them away. He climbed, 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 the ship flying almost straight up as Ronnie yammered away behind him. Right, right, here we go. There. Shepard felt the engine cut. Try to fly this thing away without power, you assholes. The ship's momentum quickly faded and then lurched as it started to fall. Rodney? Yes, yes, I know. Hang on. I've almost reroute, you son of a bitch. Reroute. And just like that, the power was back, and so was his control. It flooded through him like hot water, and he relished in it for a moment before stopping their terrible dive of death. At the same time, visuals came back, and he saw the puddle jumper skimming around rocks and the two F-302s flanking, chased by the four of his silver ships. Those silver ships had been his fleet, the AI-run ships he'd trained, with whom he'd been flying in sync, but were now controlled by the last Asgard tribe, he said slowly. He started to remember the kidnapping. They'd forced him into a device, a sort of cocoon. And the next thing he knew, they made me the pilot of their attack ships, put me in some sort of, I don't know what it is, so I could control them better. Yes. Ronnie said somewhere behind him. He still couldn't see him. He still couldn't turn his head. It's not pretty. What's not pretty? What's wrong? As he spoke, he directed his ship to chase after the four AI ships chasing its friends. Where were the other two ships from his fleet? They'd gone up. Yes, okay, I see, Ronnie said. It's a hybridized version of a Wraith ship, an ancient ship, and I'm guessing an Asgard ship? Stupid pet rocks everywhere pretending to be controls. He trailed off, and Shepard realized he could hear rapid typing. Then, damn, they're so obnoxious. Nothing here is new tech, other than what is clearly Janus' psychic link device from the ice giant. It just looks shiny. Are they that incapable of innovation? No wonder they needed you. McKay, he warned. Just keep flying. I need a minute. What a mess. Of course clone brains would think this was clever and not utterly ludicrous. Shepard grimaced, but he zeroed in on the target and vaporized one of the silver ships with a thought in what he knew now was an ancient drone. The F-302 that the AI ship had been chasing instantly went to support the other F-302 and the bandits on its tail, and Shepard took off after the two ships that were trying to run down the paddle jumper. The AIs controlling the other ship had learned from him, and they were smart. They knew his tricks, his methods. He just had to... A drone from one of the silver ships slammed into the jumper, taking out one of the drive pods. Shepard's rage took over as he unleashed four separate weapons into the silver hull. It never stood a chance. Shepard, was that you? Ronan asked. Who else? He asked. You guys missed me, eh? We'll miss you less if you can take out the other ship, Ronan threw back, amusement in his tone. Always so demanding, Shepard replied, banking his ship after the remaining silver ship. It reacted by blasting its forward thrusters, skidding to a near snail's pace as Shepard shot past it. Damn it, he snarled. That's my move. He instantly pulled up, not losing any forward momentum, as he ascended and began a loop-de-loop, ensuring he was in a whole different place as the AI ship shot missiles at where he had been a second before. Rookie move. The assumption the AI would make is that he would slow, not maintain speed, and change trajectory. As he came down, the AI ship had realized its mistake and was coming at him. But Shepard was already two steps ahead, firing into the AI ship's nose and sides, and he smiled as it went boom. Ugh, Ronnie muttered, sounding ill. This thing's inertial dampeners are not the best. I think I lost my stomach, kidneys, and possibly my spleen back there. What was that? A loop-de-loop? Hang on, Shepard said. Hang on, McKay said weakly. Again? What could be worse than, oh, God? Shepard dove under the ocean. He'd been facing that way anyway, and putting on a new burst of speed as he sliced through the water like a shark, aiming for the last ship chasing the F-302. Rodney, John, Taylor said over the radio, if you can hear us, we are heading back to the Daedalus. We have taken damage, and Sergeant Messing is not confident how much farther Jumper 2 can go. Will you be all right? Negative, Caldwell's voice interjected. Take the Stargate back to Atlantis, Jumper 2. We're under attack up here. Three rogue Asgard ships and two silver ships that have been with Shepard are firing in on our position. F-302s, radio me when you're in range and we'll bring you in. Shepard heard the echoing calls of confirmation as he exploded out of the water right behind the last AI ship chasing the F-302s down. A mental press of a button and the last AI ship exploded just inches from his hull. Colonel, Shepard said, we're coming to assist. Acknowledged. Rodney began. What? Shepard snapped, already accelerating to exit the atmosphere of the planet, the two F-302s on his heels. The jumper, he knew, was heading for the planet's Stargate. He could sense them just on the edge of his range. They were almost home. You can't go up there. Why not? Because... There's water in here? What? Your ship isn't airtight. I've been in space in this before. That's because you'll be fine. You're protected. I'm not. Explain now. You remember when Keller was being turned into a wraith ship? How she was completely enmeshed inside all those wraith cords and bindings? Shepard's stomach fell. What? It's like that. You're sitting there in a chair. At least, I think you're in a chair. But your entire body is cocooned inside wraith tech, like you're surrounded by a million red vines, and the vines are connected into different parts of the ship. All except your face, which I can see through a sort of round yellow shield, like the gold-plated visor in the helmet of a spacesuit. So, I think you'll be fine, but me, not so much. Shepard gritted his teeth. Caldwell, he said gruffly, we can't assist. McKay will die if I leave the atmosphere. Then we'll beam him out, Caldwell replied. No, Rodney said. If you do that, I won't be able to keep dampening their control over him. I need to stay here. Get him free. I may not have another chance. Can we beam Shepard out as well? I don't know. I don't know if that might kill him. He's sort of, McKay hesitated, intertwined with the ship? Wraith tech? Wraith? There was a long pause, then Caldwell growled. Fine. Do what you can. We'll stay as long as we can, but our shields are already down to 50%. The silver ships are flown by AI, Colonel, if that helps, Shepard said. It might, Caldwell out. Shepard slowed down, leveling out as the two F-302s jutted past, heading up to aid the Daedalus. The problem was, Shepard knew his ship couldn't go through the Stargate. It was just too large. Without the Daedalus, there was no way he could get both McKay and this ship back to Atlantis. If he even wanted the ship. The memory of what Keller looked like when he'd found her, utterly encased in those writhing, blood-red, sinewy cords, made him shudder. Except he could think. He was still himself, right? Keller's mind was being taken over, but he was still himself. Wasn't he? Stop. Focus. McKay is with you. He'll fix this. Of course, Carson was the one who fixed it last time, and Carson wasn't here, so... Rodney? Yes? What are you doing? Saving you. Can I have a little more information, please? He heard Rodney sigh. Yes, sorry. Look, near as I can tell, this wraith tech isn't growing out of you like it was with Keller. It's attached to you, like a bunch of IVs, but it's not sentient or anything. There's no wraith mind driving it. You're driving it. It's connecting you to the rest of this ship, which is, as I said, a mix of Asgard and Ancient. Shepard tried not to shake too badly. He remembered how scared Keller was. He understood why now. I think, Ronnie continued, that they took you because they didn't just need an excellent pilot with extensive combat experience, but someone with the gene. They're somehow managed to create a ship that has the gene-operated weapons and controls, but with wraith tech. You're not just flying the ship. You are the ship. I mean, tell me you can see all around the ship, can't you? Not just out of a view screen? Shepard frowned. Yes, it was true. And the information from all the sensors, the weapons, it's all in your mind, right? You're not seeing a HUD or anything. He thought about when he called up information. It was like seeing a HUD, but... sort of? Your eyes aren't open, McKay said weakly. Whatever you see, it's in your mind. Jesus Christ. Ronnie, he didn't hide the fear in his voice as he spoke. Flying was supposed to be freedom. This was not freedom. This was prison. He was imprisoned inside this ship. Rodney, I can't. You have to get me out. I'm working on it. I just need time to figure out how to release you from that thing you're in. I'm sure there are manual controls on this ship somewhere. I can see the Asgard design, and no one makes a ship without manual controls. Still, maybe you should see about landing us somewhere, maybe near the Stargate. It doesn't land. I've never landed it. I just fly and blow things up. Well, that's just great. Rodney, oh crap. He could feel them again, in the back of his mind, trying to make connection. It was like the sensation of cold creeping down his neck into his spine. What's wrong? Rodney asked. I can see your heart elevating and your breathing is faster. It's them. They're trying to take control again. What? No, I shut down the communications. They can't. Oh. Oh. They're not using their communication system. They bypassed that and are using the Wraith technology somehow. That, Shepard winced. That makes sense. They're not talking to me so much as. The cold was getting worse. It felt like it was numbing him all over. Rodney, I can't. I need more information. What does it feel like? You know, doctors, when they push anesthetic into your IV in your arm, it feels cold, then it starts to hurt, and your arm feels like it's on fire. Like that. Except everywhere. Oh, God. God. Rodney, fight it. I'm working to cut them off by shutting down Janice's device, but you have to fight it. Stay with me. How? Pilot, the voice rang through his head like a clarion call. They might as well have said Neil. Pilot, you have been contaminated. Return to base. Rodney, they're in my head. He could already feel his traitorous body changing course, and the ship started to climb. Block them out. Don't listen. They still need your brain for this ship to work. I can't. Yes, you can. Just focus on me, on my voice. Pilot, return to base. Hyperdrive coordinates are being entered into the system. Rodney, please. They want me to hyperdrive back to their base. That means leaving the atmosphere. And I can't. Shepard, listen to me. I'm the only one that matters right now. You understand? You have to listen to me and me alone. Pilot, you have been contaminated. Return to base. It would be so easy if he could just did what he was told. Since when do you want to do what you're told? Rodney snapped, and Shepard almost flinched at the anger in his voice. Rodney, they. No, you are Lieutenant Colonel John Shepard, my best friend and the biggest rule breaker in two galaxies. You have black marks in your record from at least two wars. You defied Elizabeth. You defied Carter and Woolsey more than once. You're telling me you can't do that now? Doing what you're ordered will kill me. Fight it. How? Think of something other than flying. What? You heard me. Anything. I don't. What is 20 times 530? What? You heard me. 20 times 530. 10,600. Why? Why do you. 7 times 506. 8,602. What? Square root of 196. 14? 225? 15? 169. 13. Rodney, what? I need the square root of 1,681 plus 7 divided by 6. 8? Yes, Rodney sounded winded, like he was struggling to breathe. Now take the ship back down. Now, please. Descending. He executed the turn, banking and descending. The liquid in his arm shivered, trying to reassert itself. Pilot, you are going against orders. Rodney, he whispered, they're still in my head. No, Rodney said, they're not. God, I don't want to, but needs must and. Ooh! Shepard jumped as he felt something touched his hand. Then that something tightened around it, gripping his fingers. There, this is crazy gross, but can you feel that? Rodney asked. I pushed through the Wraith strands, that's my hand. Can you feel my hand? Shepard gasped slightly and tried to turn his hands so he could grip back. "It's okay," Ronnie said. "You don't have to move, just..."
"I can feel it," John said.
"Good. That's good." Ronnie sounded so relieved. "Now listen to me. I've got you, okay? You know me. How many times have I saved your ass now?"
John smiled slightly.
"A lot?"
"Exactly. A lot. You save me, I save you. That's how we roll. And right now, it's my turn."
"But no, this is nothing. This, all this stuff, as scary and strange as it all is, it's still just technology. And technology is my bitch."
John huffed a laugh. He couldn't help it. Even if true, Rodney sounded like such an idiot when he said stuff like that.
"I'm getting you free," Rodney continued. "Then I'm going to make those little bastards pay for what they did to you by blowing up all their ships. Then we're going home, drinking lots of beer and passing out on the pier. Got it?"
"Ronnie, no, you are not arguing. You fly the ship until we're near the Stargate and, I don't know, hover next to it or something. I'll take care of the rest."
"But how can you?"
"Because it's me. I'm here. I'm saving you." The hand on his squeezed tightly.
"I'll always save you. Understand?"
John gave a brittle smile. "Because you'd do anything for me?"
"Yes." His voice softened. "Anything. Anything you want."
John had to smile.
"Okay. Okay. Okay. Now tell me about Doug Flutie."
John frowned. "Seriously.
What? Why?
I need to take my hand out of this yuck stuff, but I'm not going anywhere. I just need my hands free while you do the flying part, okay? So tell me about Flutie. What happened to him after he was at BU?
You really... Do you want me to start talking about hockey instead? Because I can."
"I do actually like hockey, you know," John grinned. "I mean, it's not as great as football."
"Sure, whatever. I asked you a question. Tell me about Flutie. Where did he go?"
John sighed, but as he felt Ronnie release his hand, and wow, he really missed Rodney's hand, he started to talk.
"First," he said, "Flutie was at BC, not BU."
"Like that matters."
"It matters."
"Oh, come on. Boston has a million colleges. Half that town is made up of idiot 20-somethings for that reason. I got two colleges mixed up. Does it really matter which?"
"Would you mix up Harvard and MIT?"
"Please, apples and oranges."
"Apples and... Do you hear yourself, McKay?"
"No one mixes up Harvard and MIT with anything else or each other. They're Harvard and MIT.
"Wow. Seriously. Wow. Do you hear yourself? Snob much?"
Rodney sighed heavily.
"Fine. Whatever. Keep going."
"After Boston College, which is a great school, by the way, Flutie started with the short-lived USFL before joining the NFL. He was bounced around for a while from Chicago to the Pats and then the Bills, I think. Or maybe it was the other way around. He went to San Diego for a minute, too. Then he played for Canada."
"I'm sorry, what did you just say?"
"Yeah, the Canadian Football League."
"You're joking. Canada had a football league?"
"It still does. How are you Canadian and not know this? It was a big deal."
"Football is not my thing."
"Clearly.
Oh, shit." The cold was back, flowing into him. It hurt more this time, like every muscle was burning. He groaned, unable to hide how much pain it was causing. "Ronnie, they're trying again."
"I'm almost there. It's...
there. Oh, God, it hurts."
"Just a little longer. If I do this too early, we'll..."
"Ronnie!"
He cried out in agony as the pain overwhelmed everything. As horrible as that first moment Todd had pressed his hand into his chest all those years ago.
"Help me!"
"I... The pain deepened, and John screamed, "There!" The pain faded abruptly, the cold in his veins disappearing, and a different sort of cold touched him. As for the first time in a very long time, he recognized the feeling of fresh, cold air touching his skin. He lost things then, the sense of the wind rushing against the hull, the view of water and islands he'd been directing them towards, the information pulling through his head about air pressure, navigation, temperature. He gasped and felt like throwing up, drawing in deep lung fills of metallic and earthy air to fill what felt like starved lungs. As he came back to himself, it was Rodney's chattering in the background that he understood first. "Told you technology was my bitch. Asgardian superior intellect, my ass. Canadian genius wins every time." "Rodney," he felt adrift, confused. Something was missing. He couldn't see. "Rodney, where? What is happening?" Suddenly there were hands on his, real hands, warm and strong, gripping his palms tightly. "It's all right. It's okay. I've got you, remember? I got you." John shook his head. "I can't." "Open your eyes," Ronnie said, his voice rough. "What?" "Your eyes. Open them. Come on. I know you can do it. Please." "I can't. Please. I need to see you. I mean, for you to see me. Open them, please." Weirdly, it felt difficult, like someone had been pressing down anvils on his lids. He could feel his skin almost biting him, and his eyes felt like they were burning as he slowly forced them open. The first thing he saw was Rodney. Stupid, wonderful, insane, magnificent Rodney McKay, looking down at him with wide open eyes full of worry and so much more. "Can you see me?" Rodney asked. John fell into those blue eyes. "I can see you." He wanted in that moment to tell Rodney how beautiful he was. Just perfectly Rodney with his receding hair, crooked mouth, reddened nose. He was everything. "Oh, thank God. How about moving? Can you move?" He didn't want to. He just wanted to breathe and to look at Rodney with his own eyes. Then he realized something was beeping, somewhat insistingly. "What's beeping?" he asked, frowning as he finally looked around. He became aware that he was sitting in a metal chair wearing some sort of beige-stained jumpsuit. All around him, but thankfully not touching him, were thousands of strands of wraith, whatever it was, blood-colored cords. They were sort of hovering, alive, and dripping a disgusting, viscous liquid, all creepy and just out of reach, as if with a word they could enclose around him and the chair once more. The strands extended like a starfish, arms away from the chair, attached to the ship's ceiling, floor and walls at different points. The rest of the ship was as Rodney described, bits of familiar ancient tech interspersed with some wraith console screens and what had to be Asgardian control panels. A number of the screens and consoles were flashing angrily, the beeping getting more intense. "Can you stand?" Rodney asked. "What's beeping?" "Oh, we're crashing. The inertial dampeners, which I had jacked up because you were making me sick earlier, are sort of hiding it, but I'm pretty sure we might be plummeting a bit. I'm not sure how much time we have. Might not be much." "Rodney, you were in pain. I couldn't wait until we were closer to the ground. You were screaming." "We'll both be screaming in a minute as we crash into the ocean." "I'm not saying sorry for freeing you." "Well, thank you, but now you have to stop us from dying." Rodney glared at him, then bounced away to where he had apparently jacked his laptop into one of the panels. Then he was hitting buttons and moving. Yes, okay, that did kind of look like pet rocks over one of the panels next to his laptop. "There have to be some manual controls here somewhere," Rodney was saying as he fumbled around. No one builds a ship to run entirely on one system, especially a human being that could die. Somehow Shepard managed to stand while Rodney scrambled. His legs were shaking, like he's not used them in a very long time. He realized then how thin he was. His legs, arms. He looked emaciated. He lifted his hands to his face and felt at the hollow of his cheeks, so much more prominent than they should be. How long had he been in that thing? Here, I found it. Ronnie was still bouncing, and as he shouted, a panel in the middle of the hybrid control systems opened up to reveal what was very clearly a set of joystick controls. Ronnie turned and stared at John. Right, Shepard said. He took a step and nearly collapsed. Ronnie was immediately there, getting his arms under him and hauling him forward. Shepard growled at him a little, but didn't deny the help as they reached the panel. Ronnie stayed right behind him, hands around his waist, holding him upright. Gingerly, Shepard put his hands on the controls, and immediately a HUD opened up in front of him, showing them what was happening. Oh, God. Just a few hundred more feet, and they'd slam into the ocean like a bomb. Shit, 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 he whispered, hauling back on the joysticks with Ronnie's help. Even despite the jacked-up inertial dampeners, he could feel the ship reluctantly responding, pulling up as the forward thrusters slowed their descent and the wings shifted to accommodate the abrupt change in altitude and trajectory. His weakened arm shook as he continued to pull back, forcing the ship to respond and level out just a few feet above the water. In his head, he imagined the silver ship's thrusters creating a furrow through the ocean water, sending sprays of mist and white-capped waves cascading away like moss parting the Red Sea, or at least denting it. But he couldn't actually see anything. It was all HUD information on a plastic screen, distances and obstacles and math. Is there a view screen? He asked roughly. Ronnie hesitated, as if afraid to let him go. Shepard looked at him over his shoulder. I'm all right. I can stand on my own. See if there's a view screen or a window. I'll do better if I can see what's coming with my own eyes. Rodney's ashen face nodded quickly and, with clear reluctance, loosened his arms from around Shepard's waist. John pretended he didn't miss them. Okay, okay, Rodney said, already back in front of his laptop. Shepard continued to use the information on the HUD to avoid what it was telling him were obstacles. Were they the stacks of black rock? Were they islands? And which way was the Stargate? Because he really wanted to land this thing and get the hell out. And what was that horrible, rancid smell? It was him. Ugh. Colonel Shepard, McKay, Caldwell called. Colonel, Shepard answered. Good to hear your voice. Not so good. Shields are down to 10%. We can't wait any longer. If we don't hyperdrive out of here right now, we'll lose the Daedalus. We think we may have just enough power to drop the shields, beam you two out, and get the hell out of here. Actually, Shepard said, I think that might be a good idea. Not yet, Ronnie said, and he was back to furiously typing. Can you divert power from anywhere else to the shields? I need more time. Time for what? To teach these jerks not to take our people, Rodney replied. There was no inflection in his tone. He said it with the same kind of cold rage that Shepard had felt earlier, when he'd blown up the ship that had damaged the puddle jumper. He risked a glance at his friend. Ronnie didn't look up, his eyes fixated on the screen. Caldwell must have heard it as well. How long do you need? Not long. Can you be more specific? What is it with you military types and your need for exact numbers? Give me 2 minutes. That means 5, Shepard said. He could almost hear Caldwell grinding his teeth over the comm. I'll give you 3, McKay. Then we're jumping with or without you. The view screen is the crystal on your left, McKay said then, glancing quickly at Shepard, before focusing back on his screen. His fingers were sprinting over the keys faster than Shepard had ever heard him type. Shepard hit the crystal, and above him, the metal shield covered the cockpit window, rolled back, revealing a perfect blue sky, ocean, small islands, and black sea stacks. Immediately, the information on the HUD made more sense as Shepard started to bank around the stacks of black rock, watching as vegetation puffed and exhaled as he sailed by. Then the HUD showed him something else. There were ships incoming, two of them, the last two silver ships from his former fleet. The Asgard must have sent them down after him once they realized he was no longer attached to the ship. "We're about to have bandits on our tail, McKay. You might want to hurry up unless you know where the weapon controls are." "They made three very bad mistakes, see," McKay said, his voice low and cold as he typed furiously into his laptop. "First, they took you. No one takes you. You are Atlantis. Taking you is like taking the beating heart of everything we are. There is no way in hell we would ever let that stand. There is no way I was letting that stand." "The second mistake? Combining three technologies that I know better than anyone alive, except maybe Carter. Actually, no, even Carter. Oh, sure, took me a few minutes to figure out how they did it once I was on board. But I did, and I figured it out while dizzy from your acrobatics in the middle of a dogfight, nearly suffocating when we skimmed the edge of the atmosphere, listening to you screaming in pain as they tried to steal you from me, and as we plummeted to our deaths. But I did it. I figured it out. Rodney, time." "And the third mistake?" Rodney snarled. "Their third mistake was connecting all these ships to your brain." "Meaning this ship?" "Oh, yes." His lips curled into an ugly smile as he continued to type. "Three very bad, very stupid mistakes." "Rodney," Shepard said, looking at the HUD, showing the ships entering weapons range. "I need weapons. Where?" "No need," Rodney finished, hitting a key and lifting his fingers from the laptop. "Suck it, you Asgardian assholes." Shepard's mouth dropped as the two ships on the screen disappeared in a flash of sensor chaos. A millisecond later, their ship shook from the sonic booms. Almost unconsciously, he swung the ship up higher in the sky and turned so he could see the flaming remains of what was left plummeting down and into the sea. And up in the sky, he could see more explosions, flashes of light above the atmosphere like brief meteor showers. "Shepard? McKay?" Caldwell's voice called. The Asgard ships firing on us all just exploded. Was that you?" "That was me," McKay said proudly, stepping back from his laptop, grinning. "I sent every Asgardian ship in range and communicating on the frequencies they were using. Self-destruct orders. With any luck, it took out more than just the ships here." "Well, damn," Caldwell said. "Nice job. That was pretty genius." He paused. "And Colonel Shepard, are you all right?" John was staring at McKay, barely paying attention as he flew his ship through the clear blue skies. Rodney was looking back, expression smug. He was very pleased with himself. And for once, John could not fault it at all. And his heart skipped a little. "I'm good," he said in response to Caldwell's question. "We're good." "All right, then. Unfortunately, we can't beam you out just now, as we're low on power, but..." "Wait, what?" McKay said, smugness vanishing instantly as he uncrossed his arms. "You can't beam us out?" "Not right now. Can you land that?" "No, see, you don't understand." McKay's expression was worried and Shepard's eyes narrowed. "McKay," he said. "Well, see, I didn't really have time to avoid including this ship, the origin ship, in the self-destruct order, what with the failing shields and the incoming bandits and all that. All I could do was delay it." "Delay it," Shepard repeated. "For how long?" McKay looked at his wrist, realized his watch was not the right thing to look at, and quickly grabbed the laptop. A few keystrokes later, and his face paled slightly. I think we have a little over 2 minutes left. You know, give or take a second or two. McKay, Shepard berated. Any chance you can get the beam technology up in 2 minutes? McKay asked the air. No, you're going to have to land that ship, Caldwell replied. But Shepard said we can't. Controlled crash it is, Shepard said, returning to the controls. But, McKay began. You saved my life, he replied with a smirk, getting me out of that thing. Now it's my turn. He winked at Rodney. Just hang on to something. End of chapter one. Chapter two, James Bond. It was likely only seconds, but it felt like hours as they huddled behind the large boulders on the beach. Rodney's arms were around him, the other man having all but carried his weakened body over to this location as they scrambled away from the crashed ship. Even John's heart seemed to be beating in slow motion as Rodney crouched over him, his tac vest their best protection, while different parts of the self-destructing ship exploded and ruptured and exploded again, barely 50 feet away. John breathed, waiting, knowing it couldn't last forever. Eventually, the flaming bits of metal stopped raining down around them, and the ringing in his ears from the thunderous booming faded, convincing John to risk raising his head. The boulders had been a good choice. Other than a few scraps of metal, they'd been spared the worst of it, and the beach around them was generally clear of debris. The rest was a mess. Ronnie groaned and fell away, pressing a hand to the back of his neck. You okay? John asked. No, Ronnie said with a soft whimper. He pulled his hand back, then showed John the blood on his fingers. Not really. John knelt up and Rodney turned so John could inspect the back of his head. There was blood knotting up the thick, short hair near the base of his skull, but it didn't appear to still be bleeding. Looks like you got knocked, but I don't think it's too bad, John said. There were also bits of metal embedded in the back of Rodney's vest, along with some smoking holes, though it looked like it had done its job to protect them both. You should take off the vest. It does smell a bit smoldery, Rodney admitted tiredly, unzipping and pulling it off. He dumped it next to the boulder and then sat down heavily, bare arms dangling over his drawn-up knees. They were nice arms, John noticed. Thick and corded. The black t-shirt really looked good on him. His arms, his hands. He was noticing a lot of things, he realized. And that wasn't all he was realizing. He knew with absolute certainty that he no longer wanted to fight whatever it was that he and Rodney were. Rodney hadn't just saved his life today. He'd saved all of him. Body, mind, and soul. And when he'd opened his eyes on the ship to see Rodney standing in front of him, his first sensation, his first feeling had been one of pure joy. Not just because he'd been freed or that the pain was over, but because he was looking up at Rodney. It was always Rodney. Rodney who would do anything for him. Rodney who would always save him. Rodney who would never leave him. And without a doubt, he would do the same in return. Because without Rodney, he was fine. With Rodney. How had Ronan put it? With Rodney, he had more. And more was so much better than fine. That feeling of pure joy, who wouldn't want that? And time wasn't going to ever change that. So why was he wasting it? With a contented sigh, he settled down next to Rodney, sitting against the boulder, close enough so that their hips were touching, and imitated the way Rodney was sitting. Rodney's eyes were closed, but John found he wasn't tired. He also couldn't take his eyes off of him. How you doing? John asked. He touched a gentle hand to Rodney's nape, feeling the softness of the hairs there below the cut. I think the bleeding has stopped. You'd think I'd get used to this sort of thing by now. It's a wonder I still have any brains in my head at all. But yes, headache. Bad. John just smiled, drawing his hand away reluctantly. He really couldn't shake just how stupidly happy he was to see him. How are you? Ronnie asked then, cracking an eyelid. Really? Surprisingly good. Yes, well, you smell like a burnt yak, Ronnie said unkindly, rubbing at his forehead. Just so you know. John smirked. Why would you know what a burnt yak smells like? P31517. John gave a questioning eyebrow. For all he loved numbers, he did lose track of all the planets and moons they visited. Ronnie cracked an eye, saw the eyebrow, and sighed. The one with the summer celebration like a Hawaiian luau? Ronan married the priestess's daughter by mistake? John instantly barked a laugh. Of course. Oh, that had been priceless. Apparently, Ronan's silence when asked a question about betrothal had been a sign of assent, and his further silence when asked other similar questions had resulted in a wedding celebration that had taken Tayla hours to unscramble. And yes, there had been a large yak-like creature that they'd been cooking for the party, but during the delay, after things went south, it had gone very, very burnt. The smell had been horrific. That's what I smell like? Actually worse. Ronnie's eyes had closed again, his head falling down to his chest in clear exhaustion. Or maybe the head wound. You should stay awake, John said then, nudging his shoulder. He really was wide awake. It felt like he'd just woken up after a long slumber, and he felt unexpectedly alert and ready for whatever may come. Ronnie hummed an acknowledgement, but didn't open his eyes. So John knocked his shoulder a little harder this time. Ronnie turned his head to glare at him. John just smiled goofily. Are you high or something? Ronnie asked then. He looked suddenly more awake. Oh, God, maybe there's still some of that goop in you, and I feel fine. You say that, Ronnie said, pointing a finger at him, but you have no idea what that stuff was. You could have some sort of heroin-like substance burning through you, and I'm not high. But you're, Ronnie's eyes crinkled in worry. You're smiling at me? Because I'm happy, Rodney. Precisely. Before all this, he waved a hand around, before you got taken, you were barely talking to me, and you seemed angry all the time. And he bit his lip. And I know that was my fault, but no, John said. It was mine. Rodney frowned. I'm not so sure it was. I dumped a lot of things on you, and you had a perfectly reasonable reaction, and I got angry because of it, which wasn't fair, and Rodney, John said, it wasn't you. Ronnie stared at him for a long moment, then looked down at his hands. Let's talk about this when you're better, the scientist said finally. After Jennifer's checked you over, and you don't smell so horrific, and you don't look so ill, and we know you're you, and you're not high. John pressed his lips together. Okay, that was fair. Though he certainly felt like himself. For the first time in a long time, he felt utterly at peace, like all was right with the world, or galaxy, as the case might be. In the distance, the sky was beginning to darken, rich pinks and purples coloring the wispy clouds. Then sun on this planet must be beginning to set. Maybe he was high, because the stupidest thought just came into his brain. You know, he said, if this were a James Bond movie, we would totally be having sex right now. Rodney's eyes widened almost comically. Then they narrowed and he looked hard at John. No, really, John continued. At the end of the movie, James has saved the day, rescued the girl, and they're usually stranded somewhere, like a nice beach on a tropical island near a roaring fire. He gestured vaguely behind him where the ship was very clearly still on fire. The sun is setting in the distance, and all James does is smile at the girl, and they're having sex as the credits roll. Rodney's narrowed gaze hadn't let up. Sure, you're high on something. Are you hearing voices right now? John just smiled. And wait, hang on, Rodney protested. Which one of us is James Bond? Shepard grinned even more and leaned back against the boulder. Because I rescued you, you know, Rodney said peevishly. Uh-huh. I'm just saying. Sure. Rodney pressed his lips together in a thin, tight line, still looking suspiciously at John. Then, with some wariness, he leaned back on the boulder next to him. A soft crackle came from Rodney's vest. Rodney glanced at it, momentarily confused. Then his eyes widened as he started scrabbling at it. A second later, he had the radio out and in his hand. Hello? He called. McKay, Caldwell's voice was deeply relieved. What is happening down there? We've been trying you ever since we saw the crash and the subsequent explosions. Are you all right? Oh, yes. Sorry. He patted at his ear. Yeah, I lost my earpiece in the... Yes, we're both good, just tired, and John's saying some very strange things, and I think we need medical attention. And how's that beaming technology fix coming? Not good. We're going to have to head back to Atlantis for repairs. We have just enough power to make the jump. We've already radioed the city, and they've sent a jumper through the Stargate. It's coming your way. Should be there any minute. Actually, John said, pointing out over the waves. Sure enough, a jumper was rapidly closing in on them from the direction of the setting sun. They're almost here. Thank you, Colonel, Rodney said. We see them. We'll be fine. See you back home. Safe travels, Caldwell called. And I'm glad you're both all right. Daedalus out. John huffled a laugh. For Caldwell, that was almost over-emotional. Rodney smiled. He loves us. Oh, yes, John agreed. Paraphrasing my best friend, he tries to hide it, but deep down, we're the wind beneath his wings. Rodney sniggered, and John leaned against his arm, resting his head on his shoulder as the jumper closed in on them. Rodney raised a hand to them. Inside the jumper, Tayla, Ronan, Keller, and Lorne waved back. A long, boring week in the infirmary, interspersed with visits from, so it seemed, everyone on Atlantis, except for Rodney, and John was finally released. Keller had given him a clean bill of health, smiling with genuine pleasure at his return, and he was glad to know she'd forgiven him. Turns out, getting kidnapped and nearly dying can generate a lot of goodwill. Though Rodney not coming around was a little odd. The bathroom in the infirmary was larger than the ones in the individual rooms, and he relished the long, hot shower as it sloughed off what he imagined to be the last vestiges of his kidnapping. The shaving off of the beard was heavenly, long and scraggly with first flecks of silver. He looked like a vagabond. As he put on his clothes, he grimaced at how baggy they were. He'd already put on a few pounds, though he knew it'd take a while to feel normal again. And he felt a little guilty for mocking McKay's enforced diet after he'd come back from his solar flare trip through the wormhole. Keller had him on limited, bland foods, and it was killing him not to be able to have at least a beer. Rodney had, after all, promised him a beer on the pier. His time in the infirmary had also given him time to really think about what he'd felt on the ship and on the beach afterwards. Turned out, he did have some sort of chemical in his system that was relaxing him, so Keller had explained, to make him more susceptible to the Rogus Guardian's mind's control device. But that chemical had broken down very quickly once Rodney had separated him from Janice's device in the ship. So much of what he'd felt had been, so she said, him. Which meant how he'd felt sitting next to Rodney on the beach was also all him. He'd opened a door, and for the first time in his life, He didn't want to close it. He didn't have a good explanation for why he had always been terrified to have close relationships with his family, with Nancy, even here. A therapist could probably help him understand it, but right now, he felt good about finally accepting the one that, frankly, mattered the most. Didn't mean he wasn't incredibly nervous, because he had no idea what would happen when he finally made a move, how his body would react. All he knew was he was taking the leap. He might even owe those gray bastards a thank you. Well, no. He hoped they went back to their holes and never came out again. Still, Ronnie hadn't come to see him, and he wasn't completely sure why. They'd seemed good on the beach. Things had felt normal. So why hadn't Ronnie come by? Fully dressed, he waved at the nurses, grabbed his radio, and walked out of the infirmary, intending to head back to his quarters. Then again, the answer was pretty obvious, wasn't it? Ronnie wasn't sure if John's epiphany on the beach was real or not. By now, though, he had to know. Keller would have debriefed the senior staff about all of it, so he should know that it was, that John had meant it. And yet, no Rodney. "Hey," John turned and smiled to see Ronan lopping his way down the hall toward him. "Hey, I was coming to see if you wanted company back to your room, but looks like you beat me to it." John had, in fact, just about reached the transporter that would get him to the section of the city. Still, he gave a shrug. "Well, I don't have to go back to my room." "Good," Ronan said, grinning, "because we may have a bit of a thing." "A bit of a thing?" "Yeah," Ronan stepped up to the transporter and stepped inside. "Come on." John hesitated a moment, always leery of Ronan's things, but he nonetheless followed. Ronan hit the transporter for the location near the pier. He always hung out with Rodney on. And in the moment, they were outside in the bright sunlight, heading to what looked like a picnic. A smattering of tables and chairs, looking like they'd been liberated from the cafeteria, were scattered about, along with blankets and some towels. An actual picnic table umbrella was open above a couple of the chairs. John had no idea where that had come from. And milling around were a few dozen people, including Taylor and Kanan, Keller, Woolsey, Amelia, Teldy and her team, Lorne, Zelinka and Simpson, Caldwell, and even Carson, back from one of his house calls. Laughter and chatter filled the air, just barely louder than the ocean lapping up against the pier struts below. He could even faintly hear some old-school rock and roll playing out of someone's speaker system. Ronan called a hello, and the group cheered upon seeing John. Keller stepped forward and handed him a beer. "Just one," she said, smiling brightly. "Promise." "I promise," he said, raising it. "Thank you." She gave him a nod and backed off. And then folks came in waves, shaking his hand, giving him a hug, Torn kissing his cheek messily at his mother's insistence. It felt like the kind of family gathering he'd always wished for as a kid, if his mom hadn't left and their dad hadn't made every family gathering an excuse to network. It was nearly perfect. Except, as he looked around, he couldn't help but notice Rodney wasn't there. Taylor gestured him over after the party had stopped focusing on him, the tone becoming more of a general good time, and she indicated that he should bend down so she could whisper in his ear. "He was not sure if you would want him here." He frowned, leaning back so he could see her face. "Why?" She lifted her eyebrows and he grimaced. "Yes," he said. "Fine, I get that. But I want him here." She smiled warmly, her hand gripping his arm in clear delight at this statement. "Then perhaps you could go fetch him. I believe he is just in his room, probably fretting." "Definitely fretting," Ronan said, sidling up to them both. "That's his default." He tilted his head towards where the transporter station was. "Go get him." "We will let everyone know you will return with him soon," Taylor promised. John smiled, and with a few nods to those he passed by, made his way back toward the transporter. "Colonel Shepherd." John stiffened. "To be honest, This was the one thing he was still nervous about. Not that he didn't trust the people here, but there were still regulations and laws to think about. He sighed heavily, turned, and smiled as Caldwell strode up to him. "Going so soon?" the colonel asked, a faint smile on his lips. "Just temporarily," John said. "I forgot something." Caldwell hummed, and he looked around a little. "Yes, I noticed McKay isn't here." "That's..." John shrugged. "That's actually who I'm going to get." Caldwell hummed again, nodding slightly. Then, oddly, he stepped a little closer, though he seemed a little distracted. "I was wondering," Caldwell said, lowering his voice, "whether you were aware that a few months ago, Congress repealed the ADT. The repeal came effective just a couple of weeks ago." John's eyebrows lifted. He'd known that it was being discussed, but he actually hadn't seen any final orders yet. He honestly never thought something like that would happen. "I just thought," Caldwell continued, still not looking directly at him, "that you and Dr. McKay may not be aware. Might be good for morale to let your respective teams know. Not that I support fraternization, of course, but I would be remiss to deny anyone their happiness." John smiled lightly. In his head, though, he was reeling a little from the knowledge that even Caldwell had known before he had about him and Rodney. "That's all," Caldwell said, and he backpedaled quickly. "Carry on." "Thank you," he said, keeping his voice as even as possible. "I'll let Rodney know." Caldwell grunted an acknowledgement and walked away. John shook his head and left. By the time they'd reached Rodney's door, he was a bundle of nerves. Fact is, he'd been screwing this up so badly for so long, he wasn't truly sure how Rodney would react. But he also knew he still had to try to, as Keller had said, fix this. Steeling himself, he rang the door chime. When the door opened, Rodney stood there in a pale blue silk shirt and black pants. He looked good. He must have dressed for the party, but clearly had changed his mind about going. That was evident from his hair. It was sticking out at all angles, clearly a result of running his hands through it anxiously several times. Huh. Now John wanted to touch Rodney's hair. This was going to be one hell of a ride. "Can I come in?" he asked. Rodney's expression had been one of worry, and that worry didn't dissipate as he nodded and backed away so John could step inside. John looked around the room, noting it looked pretty much the same as it always did. He wasn't sure why he thought it wouldn't. "Shouldn't you be at your party?" Rodney asked. John turned to face him and froze. Everything he'd planned to say just disappeared out of his skull. All his courage seemed to go with it. Now that he was here, every thought in his head just died. Rodney stared at him for a moment, his eyes softening from worry to dread. Then he swallowed, lowering his gaze to the floor. "Look," he said, avoiding John's gaze, "I want you to note that I get what you said on the beach wasn't real. It was the moment. I'm the last person in the world to think that anything said after nearly dying means anything. I mean, it means something, but the weight of it may not be real. And I get that. So I want you to know that I'm not expecting anything, nor do I want anything. And really, I just very much want to go back to being friends because I miss being your friend." And he winced. "I'm talking too much. I know I talk too much. It's my thing. You know that. You know me. And so honestly, I would really like to be friends and forget any of this ever happened. And can we please be friends again?" He looked up then, and John saw the thing that Keller had described to him all those weeks ago. She'd said that Rodney was a light that never stopped burning, because that was exactly what he was. John drew in a deep breath and stepped forward. "I sometimes wonder," he said softly, "what it would be like to kiss you." Rodney's breath caught, and John moved closer, his hands cupping Rodney's face, thumbs running over his cheekbones. Then he was leaning in, feeling the faint tremble under his fingers, and pressed his lips
very gently to his. The kiss was soft, softer than any kiss he'd ever had. Rodney's lips were sweet, the faintest taste of mint behind them, and they moved only ever so slightly, parting as John pressed a little more possessively. Without pausing, John kissed him again, relishing how pliant and responsive his lips were, enjoying the smell of aftershave on his jaw, the warmth of his skin. On the third kiss, his arms went around Rodney's head, fingers carting through his fine hair, pulling him in. Rodney's arms encircled his waist, pressing their bodies together. And this kiss was deeper, longer, wetter, hotter. Oh yes, no worries there. Panting slightly, he pulled back, pressing his forehead to Rodney's, feeling Rodney's own hitched breasts on his face. That, Rodney whispered, was much better than the first kiss. John chuckled, told you so, and returned to kissing him. The end.